We'll now begin with our three speakers. Our first speaker is Betsy Gilpin, who's been a member of UUFSD for 31 years, and it shocks her to be one of those now considered to be the holder of institutional memory, as the older generation of founders is mostly gone. Betsy has served as board president two different times, was on a ministerial search committee, chaired the RE committee and the membership committee, was on the finance committee, the stewardship committee, and chaired the annual auction for a number of years. Before her retirement, she was a research statistician in the UCSD Medical School, first in the Division of Cardiology, then in the Cancer Center. She retired as a full professor of clinical biostatistics. Please give Betsy a warm welcome.
Happy New Year, everyone. At least let's hope that it's not an unhappy one. As time goes by, we experience change, often significant over a lifetime. My grandmother got around in a horse and buggy as a youngster and watched men walk on the moon as an old lady. I traveled in a 1939 Chevy as a child and hope to own a self-driving car once my Nissan Leaf gives up the ghost. Big changes. However, in my era, perhaps one of the changes having the most significant impact on everyone's daily life is the advent of the cell phone and social media. Without the smartphone, people would just be tied to their computers to use social media. Without social media, a phone would be mostly just a phone. Americans spend a staggering average of nearly 5 hours a day on their cell phones. Considering that the average American is awake for just 15 hours, this means that we spend approximately a third of our lives on our phones. What did we do with all that time before we became addicted to smartphones? Read a book? Take a walk? Smell the roses? Pursue a hobby? Do some volunteer work? Sure, using a smartphone isn't mutually exclusive with completing other activities. For instance, my son uses his on long drives on relatively empty Montana highways between clients to conduct a lot of work using the phone to text via Siri or making and returning phone calls. All this he does hands-free, but still I worry. Bear with me while I present some sobering statistics. The National Safety Council reports that cell phone use while driving leads to 1.6 million crashes each year. Nearly 330,000 injuries occur from accidents caused by texting while driving. This works out to one out of every four car crashes. Texting while driving is 6 times more likely to cause an accident than drunk driving. More than 50% of teens admit to it, and over 3,000 teens die each year in crashes caused by this activity. For comparison, approximately 2,700 teens are killed annually in drunk driving accidents. While fake news has long been with us, smartphones and social media allow it to go viral without a chance for corrective fact-checking. 60% of Trump voters say Hillary Clinton received millions of illegal votes, and 40% believe that Trump won the popular vote. 14% believe that Hillary was involved with a child sex ring, and 32% are not sure, meaning that 46% are open to the idea. How preposterous! 67% believe unemployment increased during the Obama administration. This rapid proliferation of falsehoods stokes conspiracy theories and fear. Psychologists say people cannot distinguish false news from actual news because they are programmed to believe what they want to believe and are not rational. As an example, hearing about a child abduction encourages folks to become helicopter parents. The chance of this occurring likely has not increased in decades, but with a larger population, the absolute number has. So fear of it is reinforced repeatedly with each new report. That's the rational way to look at it. Well, if we as a species don't tune up our ability to think critically, be rational, and distinguish fact from fiction, we are doomed. Yes, I am leading up to climate change. Certainly, this has to be one of the most important changes that we will experience in the future. Without significant action, the point of no return will likely occur in the lives of my grandchildren. Melting polar ice caps and the resulting sea level rises will displace a significant fraction of the world's population, disproportionately affecting those least able to cope. But you know all of this. Encouragingly, the U.S. population seems to be getting the idea that climate change is occurring and is caused by human-related activities. 88% of Democrats and 56% of Republicans accept this as fact. A recent survey indicated that 86% of Democrats and 48% of Republicans think, quote, the federal government should take action to reduce emissions of gases like carbon dioxide that cause global climate change, unquote. This stumbling block is that this issue ranks well below others' importance. 31% of poll respondents think national security and terrorism are the most important issues. 28% indicate jobs and the economy. 14% said federal spending and the deficit were most important, compared to only 12% who named climate change. According to a book by Naomi Klein, entitled, This Changes Everything, even the energy tycoons and the politicians beholden to them believe that climate change is real and human caused. They just don't want to admit it. In their minds, it would lose them money to do so. How disgusting that short-sighted greed trumps the long-term health of the planet and thus of all humanity. Apparently, they need to be convinced that fighting climate change will make them just as much money as adhering to their present course. Despite recent setbacks with the Trump presidency and his choices of cabinet officers, change will come. Whether it will be soon and extensive enough is the issue. Well, you might be thinking, what do all these changes have to do with me personally? The answer is, not much, at least regarding the way I live. I do not spend much time on my smartphone. Days go by without my even using it at all. This allows me to enjoy my friends in person, make music, do art, garden, exercise, and of course, do lots of volunteer work. However, I do worry about my kids and my grandchildren and their smartphone habits. They definitely belong to the 5 hours per day club. As I mentioned already, my son drives while using his. My daughter's life is ruled by all the texts and emails that she has to answer from the anxious parents of her fourth and fifth grade pupils. The stress and diminished time that she has for other pursuits, including lesson plan preparation, is worrisome and will burn her out sooner rather than later. Climate change does not affect me much personally now, and that is the case for most Americans. We don't appreciate the need to move this to the top of the list of important issues. The challenge is how to frame the issue so people can realize its importance without tuning out altogether due to their anxiety. I worry about my children and grandchildren and their futures on this planet. Not just them, but the children and grandchildren of us all, even of President-elect Trump. All this weighs heavily on my mind, and to some extent dampens the enjoyment that I get from my very unfortunate life. Thanks for listening, and please forgive me for being such a Cassandra. Change will happen.
Before I introduce Dave Plesser, I will remind you that, or mention that our speakers all wrote their own introductions. Dave worked as a union craftsman before retiring about 12 years ago. During that time, he worked with a number of civil rights organizations, played in a rock and roll band, and picked up a degree in cultural anthropology at UCSD. He has attended UCSD for the last 7 years and been a part-time apprenticeship instructor for about 20 years and continues to do that. People overestimate his intelligence on a regular basis. You will see by his bombast that he has been schooled well in excess of his natural abilities. Please welcome Dave Plesser.
Thank you, John, and thank you, folks, for being here to listen to me bloviate to the point of boredom. Let me begin by telling a story. And of course, the issue here is the theme as time goes by, and I'm limiting myself to issues that I feel people over 60 may be faced with, because quite frankly, I don't really remember far enough back to know what it was like when I was young. So here we go. I mean, I was driving down my little town up north. The traffic was a little bit heavy, but I still was enjoying my weekly excursion through our little downtown and onto Highway 101 South. My attention, however, was captured by the sounds of a 1960s combustible red vintage sports car. It flashed. It zoomed. It barked and it squealed. Brat-like and brassy, it weaved its acrid ribbon of exhaust. Perfect counterpoint to the stalled, plaintive cacophony of summertime travel in a tourist season in a tourist town. Who wrote this stuff? Don, did you? So anyway, in the front seat of this car were two white-haired men who fit the description of retired CEOs straight out of a Centrum Silver commercial. Apparently oblivious to the rule of law, driver's ed must have been a distant memory receding into the fog of whatever. They eventually drove off in narcissistic triumph. We were left to admire their verve or recoil from their arrogance. Here's another story. If you get bored, raise your left hand. My wife and I just bought a car, and we're driving south on El Camino Real. And I noticed there's a gal behind us, 60-something, and she was driving kind of close. So, ain't no big deal. We did stop at a stoplight, and then we heard this thud in the back. And so I said, no big deal. Let's just pull off to the side of the road and, exchange insurance information and all this. It wasn't a big jolt. And so we pulled off to the side of the road, and then she goes, whoa! Bye-bye. Yeah. So I said to myself, now this has been a nagging question for myself, and my wife and I discuss this on numerous occasions, is whether or not, now she is a true believer, she believes that, and I like a difference of opinion, I mean, even in a democracy, can you imagine? I like the difference of opinion, because she truly believes that as you age, as you get older, you do get wiser, that you do get smarter, wiser. And really, this is the theme of my spiel here. And but in my mind, I just quite frankly don't know the answer. That's why I'm up here speaking. The conventional formulation that age brings wisdom is of little help here. Oh, yes, age, we are told, brings reflection, humility, compassion, temperance, and a host of other enduring values which are supposed to come to fruition in our golden years. One would expect that the unreflective pursuit of status and the not too subtle displays of disposable income would vanish, no doubt, into the long shadows cast by the enlightenment promised to us in our golden years. This is sort, as what I look upon it, as sort of an exchange relationship, or maybe a quid pro quo relationship, reminiscent of offerings given in a country to a volcano, hoping that it won't erupt. This is an exchange relationship between you and whatever you hold to be your deity. And so, in a sense, I'm able to control the actions of fate or whatever your belief system is by the giving of certain special offerings, and you make a deal with the powers that are above you. Well, this is fine. It's a not a very strong bit of theology there. It's very common. Also, I would say, we expect this reward, and perhaps as a compensation for the inevitable depredations of advancing age, we are given the promise of gaining wisdom. Once again, an exchange relationship between powers that we don't control. So anyway, I'm not here to give any answers. There's no guarantee, at least clearly from these two examples, that age does bring wisdom. Obviously, it does, and hopefully most of our cases. But I'm sure that many of you here can provide better examples of arrested development than my two geriatric adolescents that I witnessed earlier. Though the question still remains, but not, my purpose here was not to try to answer anything. I don't have the intellectual breadth or the intellectual depth to answer that question. I just wanted to bring it up, and so that at least we could take the knee-jerk conventional wisdom and just set it aside for a moment. And listen, I've got to go. All I can hope for is that I can reach emotional maturity before I hit 70, so I'm going to get right on it. And I've got to go. Listen, my Lamborghini is idling in the parking lot. My driver is getting impatient. And thank you, John. Thank you.
Clearly, you have not lost the youthful enthusiasms. Our final speaker is, excuse me, Karen Freeman. Karen wrote, "I grew up in Compton, California. While raising three children, I worked and attended college intermittently, graduating in 1974. In my late 40s, I earned an MPH, which is a master's in public health. in epidemiology, which includes health-related statistics and research, while working for 26 years in the field of medical research and writing. After attending UUFSD for over a decade, I joined several years ago and have participated in our sacred circles and Buddhist meditation groups, and have joined small covenant-like groups led by prior ministers. I've also served on the membership, social action, and pastoral care committees. Please give a warm welcome to Karen Freeman.
Well, how do you follow an act like his? So I hope I don't hear any snoring after. It's an aftermath of the adrenaline rush you just got from him. Thank you, Dave. Well, hi, everyone. I'm so delighted with this topic because it's so relevant to my life. I there couldn't be a better topic for me to think about in preparing for this. So I'm going to highlight a few themes and beliefs from childhood that through the passage of time have grown me into who I am today, and I'm still changing, of course. Both those I have an affinity for and find congruent with UUFSD principles, and the negative, dysfunctional beliefs that I've slowly outgrown, and in some I'm still trying to outgrow, and have rejected as I've evolved into who I am today. I grew up with my mom's radical Marxism. It was her religion. It was truly her religion. And when strict Marxism is your religion, you can harbor a lot of hate for others, at least in her case, and in some of those that I met that she hung out with. You know, those rotten, exploitative capitalists and the bourgeoisie. So social activism was a huge part of hers in my life as a young child. For instance, while growing up in Compton, which I assume a lot of you now have heard of it from the well-publicized movie, etc. Although when I attended there, it was wonderfully integrated high school, for instance. Just, it was how I thought the world would be today, but not yet. And I helped her move black families into all-white South Central Los Angeles that is better known as Watts, which hopefully a lot of you have heard of. And I marched with her on picket lines to fight for better wages and for better and safer working conditions for blue-collar workers, especially factory workers. And did this as a little kid in the face of, you know, ridicule often from people on the sidelines and sometimes, you know, things thrown at us while we were marching. We marched downtown, but this was a highlight, to end downtown LA to end segregation before there was ever a Martin Luther King. For some of you who may be too young to have experienced segregation in the North, it did exist. For instance, in Compton, white neighborhoods were guarded with restrictions like revoking a real estate license to anyone who sold to blacks in those white neighborhoods. So activism is good to a point, of course, but it was also a phenomenally scary time for me growing up as a child. Yes, the McCarthy era witch hunting, I think it's called that, the House Un-American Activities Committee. Scary, waiting for mom to be hauled away. And I remember I was home alone one day as a small child, maybe 8 or 9, and there was a knocking at the door, and it was the FBI. And they said they wanted to come in, and I was trembling, and I quivered a line that my mother had rehearsed me in. I'm sorry, I'm not allowed to open the door to strangers. But they kept knocking, and they said, but we're here to leave you something for your mom. Yeah. And, of course, I just thought it was a ruse to get in, and I just kept repeating that, and thank God they went away, finally. So then there was listening alone one night, crouched in a corner at a couple's home, to the gory, blow-by-blow description of the Rosenbergs getting executed. While the older couple that I was staying with were off in the other part of the room listening also. So it was really hard. So as you can imagine, my child rearing practices have changed a lot from those experiences. And that's a real, real important change for me. There are things I regret, but I wasn't ever going to induce those kinds of fears in my children because of the price that I've paid, you know, ever since. But along with Mom's great zeal and rigidity, because she had a kind of a black and white perspective on life, and wasn't open to divergent ideas, was this kind of self-righteousness. And it was partly a cover, I believe, for her internal insecurities and her, you know, deep down lack of self-esteem. Sorry for my dry mouth. So I mimicked all of that, like refusing to drop for drop drills in elementary school. Have any of you heard of drop drills during the Cold War? Okay, I'm seeing a lot of heads nodding. Well, for those of you who don't know, this is when the height of the Cold War, bombs were going to drop any time, supposedly, and we would have this training where we would have to drop under our desks and get in the fetal position and cover our heads. And I wrote here, waiting for all hell to break loose. And for anxious kids like me, it was really scary. So I was often ostracized because I said, wait a minute. You know, this is a lie. I refused to drop for drop drills. I said, the Russians are our friends. We don't have anything to be to be scared of. And so the ostracism was really hard for this shy, introverted child that I was back then. So, but the other thing that Mom had that's been really important to me were these tremendously positive traits. Her courage and her perseverance in the face of all her lifelong chronic anxiety that she lived with. But just to give you a couple of examples, she finally went back to school, stopped working in factories, got her teaching license, and went to work in an all-black junior high school near Compton in Watts called Willowbrook. And she faced a certain amount of animosity from, you know, the faculty there and the children. Not all of them, but some of them. But that all changed, and she everybody warmed up to her, and she had a very successful time there. And she was so brave in many other ways, fighting for what she believed in and standing for those things. And even when she was in chronic pain the final years of her life, she was still out there making change happen. 2 weeks before she died of lung cancer, and she was living in Leisure Village, she was out there trying to get better wages for the workers that worked at the village. So she's also a model there for me, a negative model that I've talked about, but a positive model of the great strengths that I want to try to develop more and more of. My father, on the other hand, was quiet, gentle, and affectionate, but he lacked, and he was a scientist with a more inquisitive, logical personality. But he battled severe bipolar disorder all of his life, and this was starting before there was even lithium available. So he had a really rough life, and they divorced when I was quite young. And on top of that, he lacked the courage and paid a real price for this lack of courage that he had, you know, partly due to the illness. But I've inherited so much of his inquisitive scientific disposition and his lack of rigidity that I'm so happy to have. So hopefully you've gained a sense, even with my dry mouth, of both the pain and the pleasure of having to work through this all these years. And I'm still growing on this, and I hope I never stop. And I haven't even added to this mix the mental disorders that plagued all of us in our family for really at least two generations, including both parents. I think the biggest lessons I've learned is this. I need to honor myself and my needs, and I need to be sure that my cup is filled before I can honor the needs of others. And I've learned to not pose enemies and to live the serenity prayer, which most of you know, about God, give me the serenity to accept the things I cannot not change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. That's key to me. And per our UU principles, to strive for the flexibility my parents didn't seem to exhibit, and to not only honor, but actually seek out differing opinions. I mean, that's what I love about this diverse community, that we can do that, because then we are exposed to other perspectives, and that stretches me. And in my, and this again, these are principles, free and responsible search for truth and meaning. And per our UU principles, I never want to become rigid in my beliefs. So slap me if you see me doing that, please. It'll be a real favor. You know, per our first and second principles, these are really important to me, to believe in and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Every person. Even those we didn't vote for. Even those that we see causing pain and difficulty, to try to look at them from a place of, I wonder what they went through as a child. I wonder what their genetics are that caused all that. And also justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. This has been a wonderful place to come home to. And it was really, really fun preparing for this and enlightening for me. So thank you for letting me share today.